Hello, everyone, and welcome to this utterly random piece of audio. I'm Patrick Gray. And it's funny what you find when you're going through old audio on your computer sometimes. And in this case, I just managed to dig up a 30-minute interview that I did with Wally DeBakker, who's better known as Gautier, at a festival back in 2007. And I did this interview for a Radio National piece about piracy on the internet, music piracy. And at the time I was also doing some freelance writing for magazines like Men's Style, and was toying with the idea of writing a feature about how technology is changing both the creative process of creating music and the business of the music industry itself. I mean, think of it this way. Recording engineers in the 1960s used to wear lab coats while they sweated over these massive, expensive machines. But these days, you can record an album on a piece of shit $1,000 computer, and that's a bit of a game changer in terms of who gets access to creative tools. On the distribution side, the internet has completely revolutionized the way music is distributed. Now, at the time that I interviewed Wally in 2007, the first Gautier hit, Heart's a Mess, was riding high. He'd just won an ARIA award for Best Male Artist, and it looked like his hard work was finally paying off. Now, Wally was the perfect subject to interview about this feature idea I had, because he was a conspicuously talented independent artist who had just recorded two or three albums, I think three if you include Mixed Blood, which was a remix album. He'd recorded them from his home studio, and he was starting to enjoy some commercial success, and he was an independent artist. Now, I want you to remember, too, that this was never intended to be released as an audio interview. I just needed a few grabs for my Radio National piece, but the rest of this was for a print story that I never wrote, so it really doesn't flow like your typical radio interview. But funnily enough, what we are left with here is a weird sort of snapshot of Wally's career circa 2007. So here you go. This is me talking to Wally DeBakker at the Festival of the Sun Music Festival in around, I think it was May 2007. And I started off by asking him about his first two albums, Bored Face and Like Drawing Blood, about whether he recorded them at home. Here you go.
Record both of them in bedrooms?
Yeah, but the records are both instrumentally pretty sample based, so
yeah.
You know, the actual recording I did in my bedrooms is usually either my voice, some piano, a bit of live bass, percussion,
yeah.
But the majority of the sounds are from records, the CDs and MP3s and stuff, you know.
What actual equipment did you use to record that first and then second album?
An old PC, Acid software, Acid Pro it's called, yeah. Various plugins, and that's pretty much it.
So you didn't have any sort of specialist equipment, like a clock that could sync everything up, you know, like a really hardcore rack-mountable clock?
No, I never had like, what do they call it, like, you know, a master clock or anything. No, like a high-end Apogee or Digidesign master clock. No, nothing like that. Never ran Pro Tools until recently. The big difference between Bored Face and Like Drawing Blood, the albums, was that although I made Like Drawing Blood in exactly the same fashion, working around the limitations of my old PC and Acid Pro and all its very limited busing and effects parameters and possibilities, I bounced everything out once I kind of produced it to the best of my ability, and then had it mixed with someone else in Pro Tools, someone really good, a guy called Francois Titas, who has a studio in Melbourne. So that process made a big difference to the final sound of the record.
What interface did you use? Was it just, you can't have used a standard sound card?
What did I use?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, pretty basic sound card. On my PC, I had an Isis Maxi Studio card from a company called Guillemot.
Okay.
You know, you can get them secondhand now for about $200 or less, probably.
So that computer that was an old hoopty piece of shit that you recorded the first one on, what was it? Can you remember?
Just a PC compatible. Just with, you know, odds and ends of RAM and hard drive and video card in it. Nothing special.
So was this always like a side project? Because I know that the basics, you know, I mean, you're an actual drummer. I mean, did you consider Gautier to be more of a side project than anything else? Or
I just kind of treated them differently. I guess I never really had an intention of playing my Gautier music live. And sometimes that makes people think, because I only started playing it live, that it was a side project first. The reality is, I guess, I spent a lot of time in the basics doing things that you do, which do take up a lot of time in a band, which is rehearsing and recording and traveling and touring. And I just used whatever downtime I had from the basics and work, you know, that I had to do to get by to make my Gore Chest stuff. So I never treated either one as a side project. It was more two very different type of musical projects I did, you know, as and when I could.
Did you fund the, like, mastering and the final mix of the Gautier stuff yourself, or did you actually, were you already in discussions with some sort of label by that stage?
No, well, I'm still independent now.
Okay.
So I did finish the whole mixing of everything and funded myself. I did look for a label after I'd finished, you know, mixing and mastering the record. There were some sort of possible deals and things, but nothing really came through and nothing that seemed positive. So yeah, I just decided to put it out again myself. That wasn't kind of a flippant decision. I mean, I was a bit, felt like a bit of a drag. Sorry if I spat on you there.
No, I was just fine.
Part of it, you know, partly was of necessity and partly it was of desire, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, I funded all myself, yeah.
Well, I bet you're kind of happy about that now, right?
It's paid off, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. I guess what I'm wondering is, without, you know, the advent of really cheap PCs and, you know, simple audio interfaces, you wouldn't have really been able to put this thing together, would you?
No, not at all. No. I mean, I've just learnt by the seat of my pants, you know, as I need to, that kind of approach.
Would that have been possible 20 years ago?
Well, I guess I wouldn't know, but I can only assume simply no. I mean, I don't know, you could have got... People weren't real. People were sampling 20 years ago, I guess, already. Look, I might have come across it differently. You could have used a 4-track or an 8-track recorder, I guess, and done a lot of faffing about. I don't know. I'm not sure if 20 years ago in 87 there would have been home digital workstations.
It could like a big chunky Fairlight.
Yeah, probably, yeah. Something like, well, that surely would have been out of, you know.
I mean,
Fairlights are amazing because they went from, like, you know, totally only affordable by major label or by major labels themselves, like $100,000 plus, to being kind of so bulky and vintage and collectible that they always maintained some crazy price tag. Like, they never went, like, to, you know, junk that someone wanted to throw out.
Yeah, I know a guy. He's been a piano player in Melbourne forever. He had a Fairlight and he let me have a go of it when I was a kid.
Yeah, right.
Like, cool, it's got a TV screen.
Yeah. A friend of mine found a Fairlight, like, just collecting dust in the corner of his and pinched it.
That's fucked up. Like, keyboard players from Melbourne did some time with... he's originally from Brisbane, did some time with... He found a Kona D6 clavinet under a house he was renting in Brisbane. And he's a keyboard player. He's just like, what the fuck?
One of those hallelujah experiences.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The light shines through.
And it's
great.
Now, as you heard Wally already mention, he's a big user of samples, and most of his Gautier stuff is constructed from samples. But where do these samples come from?
Vinyl, CD, MP3. I hired a lot of CDs from my local library and sort of, you know, listen for sounds and things on there, making the second record.
And that hook in Hearts a Mess is from an organ tutorial, isn't it?
It's from like a 60s kind of generic instrumental Hammond Hits album.
Yeah.
Like, you know, 12... Probably, I can't remember which one it was specifically, but one of those, you know, Hammond International 12 currently popular songs.
That's right.
Played instrumentally on Hammond organ, yeah.
So, did you worry about the copyright implications of actually sampling all this stuff?
Well, not that specific one, because if you heard, I mean, the actual bit of Hammond I sampled, say, for Hearts a Mess that ended up being that hook might have been... one little break, and I've pitch shifted that in to become sort of, you know, a gamut of maybe what, 6 or 7 notes, and then replayed my own melody with it. So haven't, you know, in that instance, it's just using sampling as an avenue towards a certain timbre of a sound that I like, that I find cooler and has more vibe than what I could create myself.
So it's not like you're just grabbing some loop from some James Brown song and making his lawyer smile.
I try to draw the line at sampling artists that are big or well known or that I really like. But then again, I mean, look, there's bits and pieces of some more well-known bands. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Depeche Mode, and I've pinched, like, little incidental bits of sound from their albums. Sure, like, there might be a couple of bass notes here or there that I might kind of layer against something and pitch shift around, or a little percussion loop that's in the background of a track or something. So, yeah, I don't kind of... But as far as sort of major musical parts of my songs, I try to have a bit of a self-imposed limit on how much I piggyback on other people's creativity. But, I mean, that's probably open to interpretation. It depends on the song as well, like... what's a good example? Something like Puzzle with a Piece Missing off like Drawing Blood. That track is all one shots of different things. So, you know, the chord progression, the melody, the lyrics, they're all original. I've written them. Any samples that are in there are all, you know, one shot of a hi-hat, a different one shot of a hi-hat, two snare drums, three snare drums, other one shots of kicks, little Hammond riffs and things that I've nevertheless then still chopped up and rearranged and kind of layered or just stretched to make some, you know, sound different.
And you did all this with a computer, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's, I mean, it's like totally digitally mediated, but the intention is usually to try and make it sound quite organic and as if it's had an analog kind of involvement, which it has here and there. Like Frank, when he mixed the record, used a few analog things like an old spring reverb, a plate reverb, and other stuff like that.
Yeah. How do you think the availability of this sort of technology, the fact that you can buy a mid-range PC for like, do you need to get it?
It's fun.
Mm-hmm. How do you think it's actually changed? I mean, do you think it's opened up opportunities for new forms of musical expression? Do you think this is going to bring a deluge of really shit music, or do you think that there's going to be some jewels that actually shine through the sea of sewage?
Yeah.
Bad metaphor, but...
Oh, short answer is yes to both. Yeah. There's plenty of, loosely talented music that's been put out and more easily facilitated because of the easy access to home recording technology, and badly mixed and low quality sounding stuff because of that fact as well. That's not all necessarily bad. It's just, I guess, people have more of a chance. That access is always better, I think, because inevitably the work will stand on its own two feet. Like, I mean, yeah, if something is recorded at home, you know, and you're not a good engineer and you're not even a talented muso, it'll generally sound like that, you know, and probably the music won't necessarily, you know.
In terms of actual, you know, your analog kit, I mean, did you use really high-quality microphones for... I mean, let's talk about, like, Drawing Blood, because that is the one that's known. Did you use, like, really high-quality studio condensers? How did you get your room? I mean, were you, like, putting mattresses and egg cartons around, you know, your spare room? How did you do it?
No egg cartons, mattresses definitely, but I didn't record any live drums. The only things I really engineered on the record were vocals and tiny bits of live bass and percussion and stuff. So
were you putting your computer in the other room and drilling a hole through the wall to get the cables in so you didn't get the fan noise?
No, I mean, that's only stuff I've learned. I mean, not what I've learned. That wasn't actually possible for me. So I had some pretty noisy vocal tracks that, you know, me and Frank... Well, Frank had to use his mixing expertise on, you know, like... faffing about on, you'd say, I guess. Expanding the vocal first to try and kind of, you know, separate the noise floor from the vocal and then kind of, you know... cutting it out or, you know, compressing it out, stuff like that. Well, not compressing it, expanding it first and then, you know, noise gating it out and stuff like that. So, yeah, there's various tricks used to kind of overcome some of the lo-fi-ness of what I did at home. And some of the lo-fi-ness we kind of discussed and we found to be positives and actually created a good vibe on some of the sound. So it's just a matter of, I think, having a critical ear and being able to tell when is it good and when is it hindering, you know, the delivery of a good sounding track.
Do you think the... availability of cheap recording technology, which was never around. I mean, would you agree that the studio companies used to use the access to the technology as a bit of a barrier to entry? I mean, it made them the keepers at the gate, right?
Yeah.
And now distribution isn't really their bag anyway, because the internet, I mean, most music these days, well, a great deal of it, is pirated. And it's often the stuff that is rapidly pirated from indie artists that becomes very successful. What sort of impact do you think this stuff is... I mean, technology at one point is lowering barriers to entry to popularity and to create good music and spread it out there, but it's also eroding the profits of the record companies. What do you think that means for the artists themselves?
I don't know. It's all matters of degree, I think. Like, you still have to spend, I think, what for an average person is a fair bit of money in what is otherwise a hobby to get a really great sounding record.
How much did you spend on, like, Drawing Blood?
Like capital investments in new gear that I felt I needed to have, you know, a better setup to be able to make a step forward in the quality of my production from Boardface, maybe about $10,000 over the course of 2 years.
And what did that mostly go on?
A G4, by switching over to Mac, buying a G4 instead of the old PC, which I ended up not even using that much. I bought a G4. I bought a higher quality preamp. I spent about $2,500 on just a two-channel preamp just to try and get better quality vocal sounds. Some external hard drives, because I had some crashes on my old PC, which meant I lost some data. I was like, shit, okay. Then I learned about what external hard drives were. So things like that added up to maybe $10,000. And then I probably, what for me was going out on a big limb, was saving for a year and a half to 2 years, apart from money I needed to live, and apart from money that I invested in the basics to make that band kind of go on, about $15,000 in mixing, mastering, and pressing the first 2,000 copies of the album.
Where did you get that cash from? What did you do? What was your day job?
Saved money. Working in a library.
Yeah. Doing what?
Customer service.
Customer service in a library. That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, some of it, I was helped out a little bit. I mean, my folks lent me some money at some stage, not huge amounts, but I mean, for instance, they did help me get that G4.
Do you worry about internet piracy? Do you worry that it's eroding and eating into your profits, or do you think it's really helping to actually spread your music out there and introduce more people to it?
Yeah, it's both. I guess it's that's a bit of a double-edged sword like that. I mean, I haven't released any music internationally on CD, and I haven't officially released anything digitally internationally. So people from the US have dropped me emails saying, I can't get your stuff on iTunes. Like, I see it's on Australian iTunes, but unless I open up a specifically Aussie iTunes account, I can't download your music.
Have you been talking to Apple about that?
Yeah, well, I've wanted to sort out actual, you know, hard copy label-based releases from indie labels in other territories before I consider getting it out there digitally. I might be changing my mind about that. My record's going to come out in Europe and Japan next year, and as yet we haven't really found an American or Canadian avenue to put the album out, and I'm considering maybe I should just go out there and try to really push Apple and see if I can get a feature on iTunes and try to use, you know, like a feature single, feature album download as a platform to actually generating that interest from labels in the US and Canada after the fact. So, and hopefully maybe getting some sales and some, you know, some income direct from that to see if people respond. But I think my stuff would have been pirated pretty heavily in countries outside Australia, because it's enjoyed a pretty good response on the web in terms of being blogged about pretty heavily. And I see a pretty heavy... It's pretty good popularity, I think, for an act that hasn't released anything in, like, you know, say the States or the UK, in terms of, you know, Last FM profile plays from people and rankings on those kind of things, and Radio Paradise and Pandora and all those kind of internet radio sites. So I would dare say, you know, considering I know the numbers of CDs that Creative Vibes, my distributor, have shipped out of a country for exports, which is not many, and I know the small number, maybe, you know, 300 or 400, not even less, probably only 200, that I've sold directly to people through my website via mail order. I dare say there'd be much larger numbers that have just gotten stuff off BitTorrent, you know. In fact, that would be the only place people would probably find my stuff. And I know that...
Do you think it's happening much here as well?
Oh, sure, for sure. I mean, you know, Australia's a pretty affluent kind of society. It's, you know...
We've all got BitTorrent, is that what you mean?
We've all got BitTorrent and access to decent internet speeds and web connections. And we've got, we've got young people growing up with disposable income, but not probably enough disposable income that they think it's important enough to be honest about buying music when they can save that, you know, when I can get that music for free. And spend their money on, well, I don't know, maybe coming to a festival, you know. Answer to your question there is, I think, things like this, you know, you can't really bootleg the experience of putting your money down and getting access to a physical event. So maybe live shows and merchandising and stuff like that that you
well,
can't.
Well, that's the Grateful Dead thing, right?
How's that?
Well, they made more monies out of mugs and T-shirts than they ever did out of recording. They used to encourage people to bootleg. So do you think that's really where the future of music is going towards, is more about the live shows and that? But I mean, that's sort of counter to what you did, because what you did was very much an introspective sort of studio guy, you know, guy sitting in a bedroom pouring his creativity out onto a, you know, lump of shit old PC, and then releasing an album that turned out to be, you know, two albums that turned out to be very, very good. You know, what's going to be in it for that guy in the future who's got no hope of taking their music live?
Well, I don't know. I mean, honestly, if the experience I've had with Boardface versus, say, like Drawing Blood, or since I put that second record out, was Boardface got a similar initial response in terms of, you know, I worked really hard and I built my own network of people in independent media and community radio and at Triple J in Australia, and after a few months of politely persisting and harassing and emailing, etc., they played a few songs, and eventually three tracks off Boardface were played on high rotation on Triple J, which is more than a lot of bands kind of get in terms of support, you know, like, say, my other band, The Basics. And even with that kind of support, you know, being a new artist and being on an independent distributor and having a weird band name and all sorts of stuff like that, I hardly sold any copies of Boardface. Like, I struggled to sell maybe 800 copies over the course of 2 years. So my frame of reference before I put like Drawing Blood out was, guy makes music in bedroom, doesn't have live show, makes an album that seemingly connects with the people who are listening to it quite strongly, like, you know, quite, you know, ecstatic responses to the quality of the music, or radio supporting it on a community level in Australia, like hitting some home runs there, in so to speak, you know, on those levels, but can't even make the sales to get back the money that I spent on buying a computer, say. So it's been markedly different with this other record, and I guess I'm just really lucky like that. I mean, who knows, maybe I'll make another record, and depending on how it goes, it might sell, you know, a tenth of what this one has sold, and I'll hope that I won't, you know, blow some crazy budget expecting to sell, you know, 50,000 copies of it or something. Well, it's all a matter of expectation, I think, and
just going back for a second, though, I mean, how much better was, like, drawing blood as compared to the earlier one was?
I think it's mixed better.
It's mixed better, but I mean, how much of that do you attribute to having $10,000 of swag in your bedroom?
It's a combination of actually saving the money and investing that in making a conscious choice to go, I want my own.
So you don't think we're quite at the point where someone can get like a half decent microphone, plug it into a laptop, and knocking out good albums?
It's hard for me to say because I mean, I don't know. Let's say I'd put out like Drawing Blood just the same way I'd put out Boardface, having mixed it myself in Acid Music on a PC and bounced it out, and then just got it mastered and possibly tried to say, you know, fix a few sonic issues in the mastering stage.
If you've got the time.
Happens, if you can, yeah. Who knows, maybe, you know, the songs would have still connected, because if you listen to my rough bounces and the final mixes, the songs aren't different. There's no arrangement changes. There's no crazy tuning of vocals and, you know, fixing of musical parts.
Maybe a little bit of compression and this and that.
There's a lot of EQ. Yeah, there's a lot of EQ and compression and extra effects and things and tweaking of stuff. So that the final product, maybe I'd be really intrigued to know, yeah. But you can never really know those things. I mean,
so you reckon that was money well spent, though, that $15,000 that you handed over for the mastering and the final mix?
Oh, for me, on many levels, I think it's a better sounding record. And that, on the level of, say, objective, how it relates to maybe market response, say, maybe that means it's a record that, you know, to a wider group of people is more listenable. Just it invites people in more so they can actually consider the musical creativity on it rather than having a low fineness in the production be a barrier to them appreciating the songs. But for me, it was also a good learning experience. It wasn't just about making a better record as much as it was about I would like to become a better engineer and learn about mixing, and it's great to sit with someone who's really great and see how they use their gear, get some pointers on how I can develop my home setup, my ears, my listening ability, my approach to how I mix a song if I ever try it myself again. So yeah, it was a positive on all those levels.
Of your three albums, how many did you sell? How many have you sold of each one today? Just ballpark, I'm just curious.
Ballpark of Boardface by now maybe has sold I think 5,000 copies maybe. I don't think it'd be many more.
That's more for the aficionados at the moment, do you think?
Must be. Well, I've been surprised. I thought the first album would sell more than that based upon... Because Like Drawing Blood has sold to date about 35,000 copies. It went gold a few months ago. So
congratulations.
Cheers. So that's, you know, that's massive. That's at least... hang on, let me think about it. That's at least 25 times what I hoped it would sell to make my money back, or for me to go, cool, this was a step forward in my career in terms of...
Did you expect it? I mean, you just didn't expect it.
No. So, I mean, it's an indication of maybe when something really takes off and, I guess, gets a platform and does connect with an audience and the retail awareness is there and retail supports it and it starts to roll.
I imagine the ARIA helped, right?
That helped with a big spike in sales, like of both like Drawing Blood and Mixed Blood. Well, Mixed Blood. So, what your question was about sales, we'll say Boardface might have sold 5K, gold sales of 35,000 on like Drawing Blood, and I think maybe 10,000 sales on Mixed Blood. So, I'd say, to me, that means, you know, that some people think like Drawing Blood is my first album and don't even know there's another one out there, or haven't taken the time to look at my website or to look at back catalogue. Mixed Blood is selling largely out of interest in the first record, but like myself, there's a lot of people out there probably like, you know, remixed record, I'd rather hear new material, or and then there's a lot of people who bought it out of interest. About probably 10K so far. Yeah. So that's been out about 3 months.
You have been placed in a queue. Your call is valuable. It's very valuable.
Internet piracy has done a lot of damage to the recording industry. CD sales are at a fraction of what they were in the past, and digital downloads have done little to make up for the difference in revenue. Despite this, Wally could already see how marketing his music as a digital-only album in the United States could be a sensible strategy, even though he personally likes to buy physical records.
Well, fuck, when you look at the number of downloads in the States, yeah, I mean, shit, compare the Australian iTunes market to the American iTunes market. I think if you have a free song for feature download on iTunes in the States, that's what, like, I don't know this for sure, but let's say, you know, that it's like 20 million downloads. That's a lot of people who are subscribing to downloading their music and tasting a new song for free on iTunes just because it's there and it's got a nice bit of artwork and you go, I'll just get the free song this week and see what it's like. Let's say even 1% of those people buy your album, you know, that's... If you're making, you know, a decent cut on the digital sale of that album, you don't have any manufacturing costs. It's the new way people listen to music, and you're actually making some income from it. I think it's a great way of it, you know. Yeah. I still like the idea of selling records because I'm still of that old school feeling. I like putting a package together that people will hopefully sit there and cradle as I do when I listen to a record and go, this is cool and I like this artwork, and even better if it's on vinyl.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for your time.
And that's pretty much it. I hope you enjoyed listening to this disjointed print interview that no one was ever supposed to hear. And Wally, thank you very much for your time. I'll leave you now with Wally DeBakker's Arnold Schwarzenegger impersonation. Cheers.
I've got Arnold Schwarzenegger's total body workout. That's fucking good.
You're going to use that, or you're worried you'll be sued by the governator?
I wonder who owns the copyright for that these days. I don't think anyone would have. Oh, who knows? He'd probably be a savvy guy. Might have some interest in his own recordings there.
Up, down, good. Now you've done the major workout. Now you can do your body's pump.